supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Ostracism. It's a word for something that really happens all the time. It's an act of ignoring or excluding. It's the cold shoulder. Ostracism is so common that we might not even be aware that we're doing it. It happens among children in the playground and adults in the workplace. The feeling of exclusion is so painful that most of us will compromise our ideals, even our values, just to avoid it. Ostracism can be hard to recognize, and that's because it's really a behavior of absence. It's the absence of inclusion. But the consequences of being ostracized can be severe. Victims lose a sense of belonging, self-esteem suffers. They can even come to question meaning of their own existence. Here to talk with us are two experts on the topic. Kip Williams is a professor of psychological sciences at Purdue University. He's the author of Ostracism, The Power of Silence. Kip, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Steve Nida. He's a professor of psychology and dean of the Graduate College at the Citadel. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Together, they've written an article called Ostracism, The Consequences of and Coping. Our phone number here, if you ever have ostracized others, if you have ever been ostracized, and maybe you are ostracized, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Kip, let's start with the very big picture about what it means to be human. I mean, it's common knowledge now that we're social animals. So the need to belong is really part of our hardwiring, our primordial brain.
Yes, that's correct. It's a sort of a cliche to say that people are social animals, but what exactly do we mean by that? And there's some really good research out there that shows that without any kind of social connection, people suffer psychologically and physically, that their immune system suffers, that they become depressed, and that they can end up engaged in suicidal ideation or actually trying it, severely depressed, and things of that sort. So it seems as though we really do need to have at least a few close social connections.
Kip, you said in one of your articles that people go to great lengths to avoid being ostracized, and we know that people will conform to the larger group and really ignore their desires and instincts. Give us some examples.
Well, one example is that we will conform to our peers. This is probably especially important for adolescents, that they will go along with what the other kids are doing, not because they think it's the right thing to do, but because if they don't do it, they can suffer the shunning, the exclusion of the kids that are important to them. So they'll engage in activities or engage in bullying or any number of behaviors that they may not do as individual kids, just so that they can be accepted and not be kicked out by their important peer group.
So jump ahead 20, 30, 40 years. Don't adults do that also?
Yes, we all do it. It's not just adolescents, but that's a particularly important time for people in terms of what everybody thinks about them. We all worry about that even as adults, but it's probably heightened at that particular age group. But yes, you're exactly right. In the workplace, We go along with our coworkers' opinions. We'll do things. We'll treat other people in particular ways that we wouldn't think that we would do ordinarily, just so that we fit in, that we don't suffer the same type of exclusion that the other people do.
Steve, let me talk to you a minute about this.
Sure.
This can go to extremes, can it? I mean, you know, the concept of selling your soul just so you can fit in.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me share an example with you that actually dovetails quite nicely with what Kip was talking about. Some of my students and I, in the last couple of years, have done some work with adolescents, and I'm talking about basically middle school and high school students. We've asked them about how they practice and experience ostracism. We've also done the same kinds of surveys with teachers of those groups, and we got some really powerful examples, because these folks are often asked to, typically we ask them to describe the most extreme example of ostracism that they've ever seen. Well, in one of our surveys, we had a teacher who told us about having witnessed a situation where 150 kids in a lunchroom together got up simultaneously, moved to another part of the lunchroom. I guess it was spacious enough to accommodate all of them, purposely to leave one young person sitting there all by himself. And as Kip was saying, we kind of go along with the group and do lots of things that, I think you have to assume that a lot of those kids certainly would never have thought of that on their own or even in a smaller group, but just so that they don't experience the same fate of that one poor young man many of them probably just got up and went along with the group.
I'm very curious about why this is in our hardwiring. Let's go to the phones. We've got Elizabeth on the line, and I think her question dovetails with mine.
I guess my comment in talking to your producer is, can ostracism ever be a positive thing? And my specific story is about how I've made a decision to exclude my family from my life, my mother, my sisters, because I come from an abusive home, and it was a very bad childhood for me. And as an adult in therapy, I've come to realize that the pain of not belonging to that group is less than the pain of continually being subjected to them. So it's a difficult thing to kind of just cut off my family, because I also have to include my children in that. They can't see their grandmother now, but it's not a healthy place to be. So am I doing something positive? Because it hurts.
Well,
it doesn't feel good.
Wait a minute. You're asking us if you're doing something positive. So
I'm asking
take a crack at that answer, Elizabeth. Before I turn to my experts, what would your answer be?
I would say it's one of the hardest things I've ever done, but the positive effects are that I'm not continually being attacked anymore, and it's not a painful place to be. Subjecting yourself to a painful thing is difficult if you're saying I'm doing this just to keep a relationship going.
All right. Well, let's talk to our experts here, because it touches on several things I want to talk about. You know, can cutting off someone be a positive thing? And you know, this gets to the whole issue of ostracism and our hardwiring. So, Kip, why don't you take a crack at that first?
Okay, it's really a good question. First of all, all social animals that have been studied ostracize. And so if something is done by all social animals, it's more than likely the case that it serves some function. And for groups that ostracize members of their group, they usually do it because the members of their group are dangerous to them, or they impose some sort of their burden on their survival of the group. Okay, that's for lions and chimps and you name it, all buffalo, all social animals. So it is a hardwired behavior that is adaptive for the group. So keep that in mind, because I guess those would be examples that it is functional and it aids the survival. For humans, we seem to know very early on that it hurts quite a bit to ostracize, to cut somebody off. And so it may well be an adaptive behavioral response that lingers on with humans as well. But it has costs. And, you know, I think your caller probably feels torn to do this sort of behavior. But certainly if being with a group is dysfunctional and harmful, then it makes sense to cut that group out at some point. On the other hand, it's very effortful. I'm sure she finds it effortful to do. It's not something like, as you said at the beginning, it's a non-behavior, but it's a non-behavior that takes effort, and you have to think about it. It's very natural for us to be inclusive and to be nice and to be polite, and it's very unnatural for us to ignore other people and to not respond to them and to not look at them. So we have to constantly be monitoring our behavior so as not to include, and so that takes a lot of resources away from the person who does it, cognitive resources and emotional resources. So it's not an easy thing to do, even when it does seem like the right thing to do.
Well, let me flip it around to the other side. Can being ostracized be a positive experience? And, you know, when Elizabeth called, I was thinking of an experience I had at a college I went to, and now we're talking the 60s, and there were very few, if any, Jewish people going to the college. I lived alone in an attic apartment with an attic room with a family who said to me, "We've never had a Jew living here before, but we'll try it and see how it goes." So, So you know, there I was. I was alone all year. I had no friends, and I studied and went to school. And in hindsight, it was a terribly positive experience for me. You know, I learned a great deal about who I was and what I could do. It was like a long-term retreat for me. So can it have a positive experience?
Well, I would say that this is a pretty good example of how, at least on some occasions, ostracism can have positive consequences. I think it's important to understand that the key variable here is the individual and how that individual adapts to the situation. And obviously, you did so in an adaptive and productive manner. But not everyone's able to do that. Or any one person's not necessarily able to do that in all such situations.
Well, and I, of course, I also had my social groups outside of college that were intact. I want to ask, and Kip, I'll turn back to you. In our species, who is more likely to be ostracized?
We have not found, if you're talking about men or women or something along those lines, we have not found any clear favorite target of ostracism, nor have we found any clear favorite source of ostracism. Men and women use it at a fairly high frequency and have it used on them in that high frequency. There are people who experience it more often in their lifetime. People of color, people who are in minority groups report having had more experiences of being ostracized than majority members. Women report slightly more ostracism experiences across their lifetime than men. But it's not as clear-cut as you might think. And certainly people who have experienced, who have some sort of stigma, either visible stigma or social stigma, they report feeling or having been exposed to a larger number of ostracism experiences in their life.
Kip, you said in one of your articles that ostracism is a form of social death. What do you mean?
Well, going back to the animals just for a moment, when an animal is ostracized by its group, it actually does die. It becomes vulnerable to prey. It lacks the resources for security and for shelter. And within usually a day, it dies. And among humans, in tribes that use this as their most severe form of social punishment, also the ostracized individuals who walk around the tribe as though they're invisible end up dying. So it's actually literal. For most of us, though, it's not literal. It's a metaphor that you feel dead. You feel invisible. You feel like you don't exist. We've even had people in our labs where we give them just a very short episode of ostracism for 2 minutes. We've even videotaped them, and they pinch themselves. They do all sorts of things that you would expect someone to do who wondered if they were existing, wondering why others aren't acknowledging their existence at that particular time.
I also heard, though, that a colleague of ours, Dan Gilbert, referred to an article that showed that chronic long-term loneliness, a byproduct of ostracism, chronic long-term loneliness can be as harmful statistically as smoking to the human body. I mean, so
yeah, that's true too.
We're talking about a physical.
And so, long-term ostracism can actually affect one's ability to fight any kind of disease, and it wears you down. You become helpless, and helplessness leads to depression, and also leads to early mortality. So, work by Dan Gilbert and also by John Cacioppo talk about the importance of loneliness in terms of our physical health as well.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get a call on before we have to go to break. We've got Susan on the line. Hi, Susan. Do we have you? Susan? No. So we'll go to Bryn. Bryn?
I grew up up above Quakertown in a rural Pennsylvania, Dutch, very traditional area of Pennsylvania. In the 50s, my parents were pacifist and demonstrated against above-ground nuclear testing. And the next day when I went to second grade, all my friends said, oh, our parents said your friends were communist and we can't play with you. And I of course, was just devastated. None of us knew what a communist was. None of us knew what above-ground nuclear testing was. And so in the 1956 election, I remember I became the biggest Eisenhower booster, although my parents were, of course, for Stevenson. I was in third grade. I knew nothing. But that was my effort to overcome the socialization or ostracism of Americanism, of our country.
Yeah, I'm curious about something. Did it have a long-term effect?
Well, no, I have my parents' politics now, and I raise my daughters in rural Pennsylvania, but I did let them take, or we agreed they would take my wife's name, so that the letters to the editor that I write don't stigmatize them.
Wow. Well, it's quite a story. Kip, Steve, any comments?
That's an excellent example of what we're talking about. You feel ostracized, so you do what you can to repair your inclusionary status. You try to become more like other people that are around you, and so you become more susceptible to social influence. And, you know, in some cases, that could be good. You could behave better. That's why we give kids time out. It's a short ostracism experience that corrects their behavior. Mm. But other times, it could make you change your values and your beliefs and your politics, in this case, to fit in with other people.
It was pretty clear from the caller that he remembers the experience well and in great detail, which is certainly says something about the power of the experience.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Listen, guys, we've got to take a short break. We'll be back in just a minute. And I want to talk about how ostracism does take place in families. And I want to follow up something on what Elizabeth said and what that all means. I also want to get to what we can do about it. You know, we're understanding more about it, but what we can do about the pain. So, like I said, we'll be back in 60 seconds. My guests, we're talking about ostracism, of course. My guests are Kip Williams and Steve Nida. Kip is a professor of psychological sciences at Purdue University. He's the author of Ostracism, The Power of Science. Steve is a professor of psychology and associate dean at the Citadel Graduate College. And listen, if you want to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Our numbers are 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Reading Terminal Market supports WHYY. Reading Terminal Market at 12th and Arch Streets has been a Center City landmark for over 100 years. The market's 80 local merchants offer farm fresh meats, seafood and poultry, plus produce, baked goods, Pennsylvania Dutch foods, and dozens of eateries, from Philly favorites to a wide range of ethnic specialties. Parking is available at the Parkway Garage at 12th and Filbert Streets. Information online at readingterminalmarket.org. Reading Terminal Market, fresh and local every day.
At WHYY-FM, we strive to bring you news and information that you can use throughout your day. Sometimes, there's just too much to tell in those short breaks on radio. Newsworks Tonight, more than a quick update on the latest headlines. A recap of the day's best news, plus all those other great stories we just couldn't fit in during the day. You know the kinds of stories, the ones that cause the driveway moments. It's the trusted local journalism you've come to expect from WHYY. Newsworks Tonight, tonight at 6 on WHYY-FM.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about ostracism with Steve Nida. He's a professor of psychology and associate dean at the Citadel Graduate College. And Kip Williams, he's a professor of psychological sciences at Purdue University. He's the author of Ostracism, The Power of Silence. So I want to talk to you guys about... You referred to African Americans feel more ostracized. And I wonder about ostracism as groups. I mean, all those years, African Americans were essentially shunned by the larger culture. Steve?
Well, as Kip was saying a few minutes ago, I think, any time... an individual or group is stigmatized in some way or another, they are vulnerable in this sense. They are targets, likely targets of ostracism. I'm digressing just a little bit here, but I think in principle we're talking about the same sort of thing. Some of our research with the adolescent students and their teachers is giving a really disturbing message that young people with special needs are particularly vulnerable to ostracism. They are easy targets, and we know they're easy targets in a sense, but it's troubling to hear the extent to which teachers are acknowledging that this is happening.
Yeah, and let's go back to the lines, because we've got a caller who... We've got Susan back on the line, and I think she was addressing pretty much close to your point. Susan, do we have you?
I'm here.
Yay.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. What I wanted to say is that I grew up in a neighborhood where there was one, we were kids, if one girl was mad at you, then everybody else feared her anger so much that they wouldn't play with you. So I would go play with that kid so that kid wouldn't be alone. So let's say she was mad at Nancy. Nobody would play with Nancy because everybody feared her wrath. So I'd go play with Nancy. I felt bad for her. I didn't want her to be alone.
Did you get ostracized by the larger group?
You betcha.
Yeah. And what was that like? Did it bother you?
It was lonely. It was lonely.
Yeah.
I kept doing what I had to do. I felt that I just had to do that for the other people, even if they did turn against me.
Hmm. Kip, Steve?
Well, let me say a couple of things in response to that. One of the things that our teachers are in our surveys are telling us is that in a school setting, a lot of the time ostracism, particularly seems among girls, happens... as kind of an organized group phenomenon, and more often than not, there is someone who is clearly the ringleader, so to speak, somebody who's social status is higher, they're more affluent, they're more attractive, or if it's boys, they are more athletic and more mature. But there's somebody who's at the top of the social hierarchy who sort of organizes the effort. So your experience, Susan, is very consistent with what we're seeing in our own research. The other thing I would say in response to that addresses you, your reaction to the situation. It's probably, you may well have had no idea how much assistance you were providing to the ostracized person, because I think it's just really important to have somebody in your corner. Having a single friend probably couldn't undo all of the harm that group perpetrated, but it certainly had to go a long way. There's a big difference between having one ally or a couple of allies and having none whatsoever. Would you agree with that, Kip?
Yeah, I would, and I think it is important that and laudable that you did that. The other thing that you experienced, the ostracism that went along with deciding to befriend the girl who was ostracized, if there's one thing that we have found in our research, is that one of the problems of ostracism is that, unlike being yelled at or called names or even hit, is that it's difficult to know what to do back. You can't argue back. You can't fight back. It's like you're invisible, so there's no recourse. And one of the psychological impacts of that is that it strips you of any sense of control, and when you lack a sense of control, that makes you feel eventually helpless. But one of the nice things that you did is by choosing to do something that you knew was you were going to have to pay the price for by becoming ostracized as well, that actually can buffer that lack of control experience, because you're basically taking control and you're saying, I'm doing this, I know it's going to happen, but I'm doing it anyway because I believe in it. And that taking of control over the situation can make the ostracism that you experience less terrible than it is.
You know, guys, we've been talking about hardwiring a lot and how ostracism and ostracizing is part of our hardwiring. But Steve, let me turn to you. What Susan did is also part of our hardwiring. We are wired for compassion. There's a lot of research about that, that our first instinct when we see suffering is our hearts open. We feel compassion.
Well, certainly that is the case some of the time. And again, there's you're correct, Dan. There is research that supports that. What we really can't speak to very precisely is what happens when those two forces are kind of pitted against one another. Mm. Which one wins out, so to speak? And I'm not sure that that's probably an oversimplification of a lot of things to try to pose the question in those terms. But that's where situational factors come into play.
Yeah.
That's where the upbringing and socialization that the individual involved in the situation will come into play. And again, in Susan's case, I would venture to say she probably had some positive influences in her life that led her to do the right thing.
Yeah.
In the situation that she described.
And probably
to us.
Parental values that she saw at home. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Bob on the line.
Hello?
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hello.
What I wanted to say is that I am a victim of ostracism, and it brought me to the brinks of suicide. When I'd say I'd staved off suicide for at least 3 years of my life. I wound up going to counseling for probably 10 years, or no, probably more like 20 years after that, and it really the impact it had on my life is just profound.
Tell us what that impact was. You just said suicidal, but what is the impact, Bob?
I had rage. I'd actually called in once before Dr. Gottlieb and mentioned that I wanted to take my life as a way of preventing myself from from murdering other people, and those other people were my abusers. And so, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit at sea here. I don't know where to go next.
You're doing fine. That's exactly the question I answered. And one more question, and then we'll turn to the most important question, Bob, is what would you like? I mean, you called here. Tell us what you would like. What would you like to hear? What would you like to get?
I think really at this point in time, because I've had a lot of counseling, and I'm really through my issues on it, I just basically wanted to be able to offer my experience. I don't really need any validation. I've kind of gotten that already through all of my counseling. There's a quiver in my voice because it's kind of like it's emotional to talk about, but I really am, what I'm talking about happened like 35 years ago.
Are you offering your story to help others?
Yes.
Okay, so what would you like to say to others who have been ostracized and who are suffering?
I guess I would like to say that to not act on your rage is to become the savior of your abusers. And also that, you know, one thing I fell into when I was in the depths of it was if you need help, you need to make noise. I equated it to being lost in the woods, and I needed to make noise so that other people would find me. And I didn't care. I had to make the decision that I didn't care what I looked like in making that noise. I just I didn't have the wherewithal to get myself to counseling. My way getting help was to, you know, I kind of elicited help from anybody who would hear me, you know. I think
your metaphor is so very powerful about being lost in the woods and hollering. One thing I would mention to you, Bob, is that, and I don't know if my guests would agree with me or not, but one of the things that happens when you're ostracized and you're alone in the woods, that in that crisis, and what you're saying is that crisis mode can last for 30 years, in that crisis, we tend to abandon ourselves. So we're even more alone. So we're not connected with ourselves, with who we are, with the part of us
that's
suffering.
Right.
And then you're exquisitely alone. And if you can reconnect with who you are at your core, you're less alone.
Yes.
All right. Just a thought. I'm going to turn to our ex. And Kip, I mean, Bob, thanks so much for your call. I appreciate your courage in sharing your story. And I can't tell you how happy I am that you've made some of the decisions you've made. Thanks so much, Bob.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself.
Bye.
So let me get a reaction first from you, Steve. Any thoughts?
Well, one of my reactions is to try to make a point that takes us back to the laboratory research that Kip and his colleagues have conducted over the years. And again, the bottom line is that research shows definitively that an apparently trivial kind of experience, a couple of minutes of being ostracized, has predictable and pretty powerful effects, and we're talking about 2 minutes. Now, by way of contrast, think about an individual who's had to deal with, you know, extreme ostracism over an extended period of time, perhaps at the hands of people that he cares about and that are in a position to have a lot of impact on that individual. Needless to say, the power is magnified exponentially, and so it was pretty clear to me from listening to Bob that he had dealt with quite a bit, and he's to be commended for showing the courage or demonstrating the courage to address the
the power of the ostracism that he had experienced. And again, my point is, if you can make something significant happen in a couple of minutes in a trivial situation in a laboratory, just imagine what happens when people endure this kind of thing for years and years and years.
Kip, I thought of some of your writing when Bob was talking, when you described exactly his behavior when people are facing extreme ostracism, that if there is no way to get back into the group, that they can become suicidal or they can become violent.
Yes. That does seem to be a key factor, is whether or not you think there's a chance for reinclusion with either the people who are ostracizing you or just as well somebody else. And as long as you think there are opportunities for reinclusion, then typically people will basically work at trying to become more attractive or more likely to be included. But if they think the chances of re-inclusion have been cut off, then it becomes more important to be noticed and to have an effect on other people, to provoke responses, just to say, hey, look it, I'm important, you need to pay attention to me. And then they don't seem to be as concerned about being liked as much as being noticed. And at that point, people can become violent.
And you've mentioned some of these school shootings, certainly Columbine.
Yeah, there's some very interesting analyses of both the diaries and the reports about school shooters in America, finding that the vast majority of them were suffering from some sort of ostracism or rejection or exclusion from their peers. Now, I want to make sure, though, that I indicate that most people, we all experience this to some extent, and lots of people experience it for a lot of time, and they don't go off shooting.
Right.
So there has to be a whole set of constellation of personality factors and things of that sort that would make a person go to that extreme. But what your caller, what Bob says, is he felt rage, and that's precisely what we find. I have a very short quote from William James that I think you'd find very interesting, in that it says something very similar to what Bob just said. Can I read it?
Sure.
It says, if no one turned round when we entered, answered when we spoke, or minded what we did, but if every person we met cut us dead and acted as if we were non-existing things, a kind of rage and impotent despair would ere long well up in us, from which the cruelest bodily tortures would be a relief, for these would make us feel that, however bad might be our plight, we had not sunk to such a depth as to be unworthy of attention at all.
Hmm.
And I think we hear that rage point,
yeah,
but
yeah.
We also hear the idea that we've had with a lot of people that we've talked to, is they say, I'd rather have been beaten by my spouse than being given the silent treatment for a year. And we'd say, why would you say that? And they say, well, yeah, first of all, it proves that they know I exist, and second of all, I can take my bruises to the police. I cannot take silence to the police. And so sometimes people, luckily Bob received therapy where the person obviously was attentive to what happened to him and saw it as an important thing. But we have had a lot of reports that therapists even sort of trivialize being given the silent treatment, and they kind of say, well, at least you weren't hit. But this is a type of hurt that is just as painful and probably has longer lasting implications.
Well, I have good news for you. Therapists need to be trained about this, and the good news is a lot of therapists listen to this show. So,
great.
We're having an impact on that level. Listen, we've got to take a short break again. When we come back, I want to talk about research about how ostracism and physical pain affect the brain in the same way, and we've got to get to what we can do about it. What is therapeutic for that? We're talking about ostracism. My guests are Kip Williams, Steve Nida. Kip's a professor of psychological sciences at Purdue. He's written Ostracism, The Power of Silence. Steve's a professor of psychology and associate dean at the Graduate College at the Citadel. We'll be back. You're listening to WA. You're listening to Voices in the Family. I'll get that right. And we're here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University in its eighth season, featuring General Stanley McChrystal, food activist Michael Pollan, Valerie Plame Wilson, and Ambassador Joe Wilson, and Tom Brokaw. Seven evenings at the Kimmel Center designed to enlighten and inspire you. An exciting season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation. Information available at PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org. Sponsored by WHYY.
People who live with obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, don't always show it. Author and OCD sufferer Tracy Faust said she got used to covering it up.
People who have anxiety problems, they get very good at acting like everything's okay.
In her memoir, Nowhere Near Normal, Faust shares her secrets of growing up and coping with OCD. We'll hear her story next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about ostracism, such a powerful and important topic that all of our phone lines have been lit up for the entire show. And I'm sure my guests aren't surprised about that. They are Kip Williams, professor of psychological sciences at Purdue, and Steve Knight, a professor of psychology and associate dean at the Graduate College at the Citadel. I want to talk to you, Kip, about your study I alluded to earlier. Steve's talked about your research about ostracizing people in the laboratory. It's done with a virtual game called Cyberball, where people get ostracized. But you've had people play this game while taking a functional MRI. Tell us what you found.
Well, the game is such that you think that you're tossing a virtual ball with two other people, and they are shown on the screen as a sort of cartoon characters. And when and if the ball comes to you, then you click one of the other characters to throw them that ball. The cover story that we use in our research is that we're just interested in mental visualization, and all we want them to do is to think about what these people look like, where they are, what the geography's like, what the temperature's like. And we tell them that it's not important who gets the ball or anything. It's just a chance for them to exercise their mental visualization skills. Half the people are playing the game where they get the ball thrown to them an equal number of times to everybody else, so they get the ball a third of the time, but the other half have been randomly assigned to get the ball once at the beginning and then never again. And this very minor or seemingly innocuous manipulation, because it's done by people they've never met and that they don't plan to meet in the future, and no information about these people, they're total strangers. And yet, nevertheless, 2 minutes of this makes a person self-esteem drop. They feel less belonging, less control over their social environment, and they feel that their existence is more meaningless. They also feel anger and sadness. What we didn't know is how it affected their brains. So we put them, we had them play this game inside of an fMRI chamber, and then watched what happened in their brains when they were ostracized compared to when they were included, or compared to when they were at a rest state. And what we found was profound activation of the dorsal anterior cingulate, which is the same region of the brain that is activated when people experience physical pain, like if you touch fire or touch a sharp object. And so the same apparatus in the brain seems to be used to detect pain of any sort, social or physical. And the amount of activation of that part of the brain was highly correlated with their self-reports of how badly the experience went for them.
And certainly that's true for emotional pain, too. So social, emotional, and physical pain all light up in the same part of the brain.
Right. So, and one interesting difference, though, is that although they seem to be registered in the same place, if you think about a time when you were physically injured, where it was very, very painful, you can remember that as being very painful, but thinking through the incident where the physical pain occurred does not make you feel pain now. It does not reinstate the pain. However, just like Bob was choking up talking about it, when you think back at a socially painful experience like ostracism, even if it's been years and years ago, and you sort of step through the process of remembering how it went, then you can feel that pain all over again. So it's a pain that keeps on living.
A kind of post-traumatic stress disorder.
But not as severe, yes.
All right, so let me turn to Steve. And I always feel guilty when I ask a researcher this question. So if the same part of the brain lights up for physical pain and social pain, let's talk about treatment. What are the treatment implications?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the expert to talk to about that, but I would offer one interesting point. Another of my favorite studies in the last couple of years that speaks to the same issue is a study that a guy named Nathan DeWall did at the University of Kentucky, and he and some of his colleagues in a couple of studies put participants on a regimen of Tylenol or were in a control group. And in one of the studies, they monitored basically, you know, how much social pain they had felt, what was the sort of the status of their feelings. And after several weeks of the Tylenol regimen, over that period of time, the people that had been taking the Tylenol reported less social pain than the control group did. And then another experiment within that same paper, they subjected the participants to an experience of rejection, and again, the same sort of thing was found. The folks who were taking Tylenol were, I guess, probably generic acetaminophen, but in any case, those folks reported less social pain from that rejection. So it's just another interesting, example of how we seem to have a neurological basis for this.
That is interesting, and it's interesting in terms of treatment, but let me turn to you, Kip. What do we know about psychotherapy? Any psychotherapy for ostracism? What do we need to learn?
Okay, well, so as Steve just said, both of us are actually experimental social psychologists, and so we don't want to pretend to be clinicians or therapists, and so it's we feel like we need to sort of preface what we say about this. My feeling is on this, first of all, if I could just respond to the study Steve just said, is that my feeling is that the pain we experience when we detect ostracism is functional and it's useful. That it's just like saying, well, if you give people a lot of pain medicine ahead of time, they won't feel as much pain when they're burning their finger, but you wouldn't want them not to feel that pain because you want to learn from that and to sort of behave in ways that can help you prevent from feeling longer pain in the future. So my feeling is that you don't want to treat the initial pain response so much as you want to help with coping. And our research would suggest that anything you can do to strengthen any social bonds that a person has with other people that matter to them helps them cope helps them recover from the ostracism experience much more quickly.
So the treatment isn't completely in the psychotherapy office. That a lot of most of the therapy, since it's a social injury, has to be done in the social area, not necessarily just
well, and perhaps it's because we come as social psychologists, that's the way we would say it. I mean, there are other factors that, like cognitions, start to change if you start to come to the point where you're giving up and you feel like there's no chance of re-inclusion. Some of that is a sort of a cognitive behavior sort of approach, because these responses of I am worthless, nobody likes me, there's no chance that anybody will take me in, would be the sort of thoughts that cognitive behavior therapy would work with to say that these are generalizations that are not really rational or accurate, and that you need to focus the thought on the specific person who did it to you rather than on your underlying worth as a human.
We've got a caller on who I think makes a great point. Olivia?
Yes.
Hi. We've got to ask you to be real brief. We've only got a couple minutes left.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of a holistic thinker, and I can't help but wonder how our punishment system, from time out as children to jail as an adult, is probably some on some subtle level teaching ostracism to others, perhaps?
There you go.
Yeah. Well, I don't really think it's teaching. I think it is basically something that we all have a pretty good understanding of from the get-go as children, that it's a punishment that hurts and that's quite effective. But certainly we seem to sanction it. We seem to say it's okay to do, and we think of time out as a more humane treatment than a short, you know, swat on the rear end. And so, but I would ask people that use timeout, because I use it too, I have two children and that I've had to use it on occasion, to think through the process and to think what it's doing. And if it makes them feel fragile and spineless, and that they either want to just try to please to avoid that kind of social punishment, or they want to act out to get attention, that's not really what we're trying to achieve. When I've done it with my children, I give them some control. I say, when you think you can come back and apologize to your brother or to your mother or whatever, then you come back and do it. And so I at least give them control over when the timeout is over.
That's a great idea.
You know, you're right. It is sort of institutionalizing the appropriateness of ostracism. But then you have to compare it to other forms of punishment and, you know, which ones are more or less humane.
Yeah, and like with any other behavior management technique, not only is it important to send a signal about what the wrong behavior is and what you want to get rid of, but you also need to make sure that the person who's the target of the timeout knows the appropriate course of action. And as Kip said, then you essentially empower that person to exert control over his environment by his or her environment by engaging in the proper behavior.
And I like what you guys say about giving control back and understanding. I do want to mention to Olivia that I frequently put myself in timeout, and it's I kind of like it. I wish I could do it more, but whenever I'm bad, I put myself in timeout, which is probably why I like to be bad. But we'll leave that. That's for another show. Guys, we are completely out of time. I want to thank you so very much. The show's been wonderful and I think important and certainly touched a lot of people's lives.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. It was great.
Kip Williams is a professor of psychological sciences at Purdue University. He's the author of Ostracism, The Power of Silence. Steve Knight is a professor of psychology and dean of the Graduate College at the Citadel. And together they've published Ostracism, Consequences and Coping. It appears in Current Directions in Psychological Science. Well, next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about spirituality and technology and how they interface with our lives. You can reach us if your comments or questions at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Emily Haas is our intern. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends. Tell me more.